education. I answer a call at home, which is one of the reasons I'm here all the time. Answer a message of correspondence at home. And we have a vast file of material in this area. And I encourage everybody to come to us when they have a problem. And sometimes the letters don't get answered for a month or two, but we get misplaced. But in general, I think people have been quite satisfied with the information we've been given. And we'll run tests for them if necessary. And, we do need some help, and that means finances. And I hope the time will come when... What my original idea down there was that I had established the conservation lab, and I would be responsible for it, but that we would hire a lab assistant, the kind of person who would fit in very well there would be an RIT graduate who had chemistry and photography. And then I would teach him the techniques for the chemical testing and restoration techniques and so on, and eventually he could take over. So far, it hasn't worked out that way. I think it's because of funders, and Andrew Larson. And partly, well, Alice is splendid in her field, but she's a paper restorator. And that's all right for mounting and unmounting prints and things like that, but it doesn't tell you whether it's a platinum print or a gum dichromate print or whether it's going pieces in 50 years and so on. You know.
You probably need really three or four people, ideally. I mean, one of whom might be a paper conservator.
Oh, yeah. I think if we had a proper staff, we should have a paper conservator. But see, the first thing a paper conservator does is to test the acidity of the paper. Well, that's all right, but it doesn't tell you whether it's going to affect the image at all. And I think, actually, a lot of these permalife things and so on, which have been, especially alkaline, with pH of 8 to 9, are going to be bad for color prints. I think a lot of the mounts, I have the dyes in the color photographs, many dyes in color photographs are indicator dyes. That means that, they change their color with a change of acidity or anthropogenicity. And I think a lot of these mounting boards are too alkaline, and I think we're going to find that the color prints aren't going to necessarily be stable on them. Some are, depends. If there are pigment prints like carbro, carbon, three-color carbon, and so on, and perhaps some of the azo dye bleach prints, which are made of stable dyes or stable pigments, may be all right on them, but dye transfer prints I would worry about. But they're among the most stable prints that there are. But if you put them on a highly alkaline board, I don't know what's going to happen to dyes in the easy test. But we've seen no evidence yet of any problem. But some of the modern color print processes, which are very sensitive to their environment, even if they're kept, as was recommended, cold and dry and in the dark, which all color prints should be anyway, the mount itself, if the mount has got the wrong pH, it may change the color of one of the layers. But these are all subjects that we should be investigating down in the conservation lab under accelerated testing conditions. Now, we had a Kodak research lab. It came in my division, had a tropical research lab in Panama, which is one of the best things that they ever did as far as I was concerned, because the conditions in Panama are the worst possible. We chose Panama for that reason. We had a field station on Barra Colorado Island, which is in the middle of the Panama, in Gatun Lake, in the middle of the Panama Canal. It was, when they built the canal, it was a popular subject kind of thing.
Yeah.
When they built the locks and the dams, they built three locks of the Gatun locks at the Atlantic end, and they built the Pedro Miguel and San Pedro locks at the Pacific end. The water came up, and built the dams and put the gates in. The water came up 83 feet. The canal, the level of the lake in the middle of the canal is 83 feet above sea level. It's fed by gravity from a mountain lake which is higher up in the hills, so they don't have to pump it in this fresh water. But when they built the dams and things, the water came up and isolated the hilltops. And that made a number of small tropical islands with the primitive vegetation and the descendants of the primitive wildlife. And one of those, called Baracolorado Island, is in the lake there. It comes under the auspices of the Smithsonian, and it's a place where botanists and wildlife people go and study. We had a field station in a clearing in the jungle there. This was a typical tropical rainforest area. And we had a clearing in the jungle, and we had a field station there where we could subject things to the most violent conditions as far as the deterioration is concerned. Then we also built in 1949 a research lab itself, a building itself in Panama City, where we could do the accelerated testing under lab conditions, or where we could do the chemistry and everything that was involved. We learned a lot from there because our temperature and humidity recorders on Baracolorado Island, let's say, for example, the temperature will down there is not too high, not like deserts. It will run about 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. It will drop perhaps from 90 to 75 for nighttime. It never gets below about 75. The relative humidity is always high, and you know, when the temperature drops, the relative humidity goes up. So when the temperature drops, say, from 90 to 78 in the daytime, relative humidity, which may be 85, goes up to 100% at nighttime. Every day, without fail, so to get saturated air and high temperatures. And that contributes to deterioration. The tropical vegetation is always decaying, giving off the hydrogen sulfide gas and ammonia and so on. And these things will affect your sprints and negatives. And also, the biological factor is a very important one, because whenever the relative humidity, this is an important factor, remember, in any storage area, fungus will, in general, not grow below a relative humidity of 65%. But if you have an environment above 65%, you've got to watch out for fungus growth. And in addition, not only fungus was a problem down there, when you put your boots in a closet overnight and they come out all green in the morning, that's why they have so-called dry closets where they have an electric lamp burning at the bottom all the time to raise the temperature inside about 10 degrees or so and cut down on the fungus. In addition to the fungus, you have insects. And insects love the gelatin. Silverfish, cockroaches, carpet beetles are the three most important ones down there. And if you hang up prints in the open, very often you will find little holes have been chewed in them by these insects. They love the gelatin, that chewing of the gelatin, which comes with prints with holes, but gnawed out with the little mandibles, and the fungus are two of the big problems down there. And this is a very good place to get experience in this respect. And there was no better place for me and the staff down there, some of whom are now back in Rochester, to learn the importance of humidity and temperature as far as storage conditions are concerned. Remember that rule, never store anything above 65% RH if you can avoid it. Well, that contributed to some of our knowledge. And one thing we did was to investigate 800 chemicals as possible fungicides to prevent the growth of fungus or to kill it when it is growing. In other words, soaking prints or negatives. or leather, camera, bellows, anything of organic nature. We investigated about 800 chemicals for fungicides and selected about half a dozen, and only two of which are really effective, and they are not generally effective. There's a compound called zinc fluorosilicate, which is good for black and white negatives. For black and white prints, it tends to make them go slightly yellow. It's not good for color prints because it has very acid. Then there's another quaternary ammonium compound called hyamine 1622, which is made by Roman Haas, which is a very good fungicide for prints of all kinds. So we have two recommendations for fungicides, one for negatives, black and white negatives, and the other for prints and color materials.
Are either of those chemically similar to the compound I know by the name thymol?
No.
That's a separate
thing. I think thymol is a chemical which was used by paper conservators, and they worship it unnecessarily because it's not a very good fungicide. I've been trying to, I think I've been unsuccessful, trying to advise Alice and Mary not to put in a thymol cabinet there because I don't think it's effective enough. And I've been looking through recently the classical books on fungicides and insect control and so on, and I don't even find thymol mentioned in them. But these are the paper people. They think that you have to put paper in an atmosphere of thymol.
Yeah.
In manufacture of paper, they sometimes use thymol. They use more often diazide G, which is pentachlorophenol, one of the diazides, which is a very good fungicide. But there again, you have to know enough chemistry to be cautious. You have to know that all organic compounds that contain chlorine, and that applies to polyvinyl chloride, sheeting for envelopes and all this, that and the other, they call them vinyl. In course of time, and especially in light, they give off chlorine, or hydrochloric acid, and the chlorine of the hydrochloric acid will affect whatever's in there. So that's an objection to diazide G, which is a chlorine compound, and it goes to pieces. We've done experiments on that in Panama, and solutions of it, you leave it out in the daylight, go brown within a very short time. So I think the two things that I mentioned are the best. There is a publication by Kodak, Notes on Tropical Photography, in which these are all listed at the end, but if you don't, I can get a couple of them if you're interested. There is quite a list of Kodak publications dealing with this subject, and if you're interested, I can get hold of a batch of them for you. There is a new one coming out, which has been in the works for a couple of years. It must be, because I read the manuscript 18 months ago. F30 on conservation and restoration of photographs. And that's going to be, I think, the most authoritative publication. It covers the whole field. And its manuscript is ready. They asked me to go through the stuff in the Eastman House here and see if I can find illustrations for them. And I think we've got four illustrations, but I try to steer them away from that one we were looking for the other day. I don't think it's significant, actually. But that's going to be a good book. That will be out, I suppose, within the next 6 months. But if you want me to get together a batch of publications for dealing with the preservation, conservation, or so on, the special problems, I can easily go down and find them. I should have brought that along. I have a short bibliography, again, that's down in the basement, on conservation of photographs.
These interns probably won't get too heavily into that.
No. But if you are interested, I can let you have references.
You have it in your files downstairs.
Yeah, I'll be in my file downstairs, yeah. What are the intern's special interests here?
Well, we have an art historian.
Yeah, I know that. That's why I apologize in advance.
Sam is a film scholar.
Oh yes, right.
And Rick is from a program at University of Minnesota called American Studies. It's for English people who don't want to teach English.
Well, that's no noble. That's noble. Oh. Anybody wants to know anything about English, come see me.
No, he can tell you. I'll let them speak for themselves.
Well, there are some, great, there are some historical notes here. For example, there is a biography of Beaumont Newhall when he became the director.
What, is that a like a press release, you mean, or is that just a...
This was a press release by George Eastman House.
Oh, man, I look here for you.
I also have a file somewhere of all the... I know how the motion picture collection started. Kodak had a big motion picture film collection. When the Eastman House was started, Kodak handed over from its film vault all the early films that they had. And that was the basis for the collection that Jim Carter got from there. Now, I have a list of all those films that were presented, taken out of the vault and were given to the house. And you might be interested to have a copy of
that. Yeah, I remember some story from Jim about they decided to reduce the number of nitrate vaults they had over there.
That's right, yes.
And they were literally ready to destroy the stuff if it couldn't be accommodated almost just like that.
That's right, yes. That was so, yes.
And there was quite a scramble to do anything about it.
Right. And Charlie Ives, a man named Charlie Ives, who was in the research lab in the motion picture division, and was responsible for the collection. And there was some talk about duplicating everything on the safety film and throwing away the nitrate originals. But then they said, well, it worked out that they were presented to John Eastman House. One of the benefactors built the film vault in the back there, which was all right at the start, but it's, as you know, it's very inadequate at the moment.
Yeah, that's a curious building. It's sort of a Greek temple on top of cinder blocks or something.
Well, it was when you store film, you have to have it on open shelves with good air circulation around it, and you have to vent it so that you have to have these roof vents in the roof, and so on, and that becomes part of the peculiar architecture of the place. But they've got them stacked on the floor and got an annual shed across the way. Oh, it's frightful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ashamed to bring people into the house who want to know about how to preserve photographs. Well, if you're interested in any of these other aspects or want any help in identifying processes and so on, let me know. Glad to help in any way. I think we ought to publish a publication from the house on identification.
Yeah, I was just thinking that from watching
processes.
Debbie fight with things and try and figure out to catalog something what it is. She
can't
tell.
Yeah, well, she asked me once in a while and I'm able to help with something, but not all.
Frequently, I'd say.
But,
yeah, it would be good if there were really.
Well, I'd be delighted to help in any way, you know, in that respect. And, largely because I probably run into more processes than most of the people around here. That's all.
Good intern project.
But right. Yes, and also the people who are interested in the graphic arts, how to identify the printing processes.
Yeah.
Whether it's color type or gravure or letterpress or what, you know.
Yeah, that would be a very important part of it, really. Too.
Yes. Well,
so much of the material is.
Especially with the 3M collection and with the Ada collection. And a lot of stuff that I've been collecting during the years, for example, the first newspapers in which color reproduction was done from Kodachrome and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, They're all of interest, but was it lithography or letterpress or color type?
Boy, are those newspapers fragile, I want to tell you.
Oh yeah, they're fragile. Yeah.
We've got to do something about them.
I think the only thing to do is to interleave them between
Mylar
or acetate sheets.
Capsule them.
Because all newspaper is going to use it. It's very acid, it's got resins in it which give off peroxides, it's got lignin in it which...
It's not the best paper in the world.
No, it doesn't really, no.
When you take the material that you brought into the house and add it to the stuff that Sipley had, there's a remarkable collection of newspaper tear sheets from the late 20s, with color reproduction in them.
Yeah.
And the color is better than you get out of the Times Union.
Oh, much better.
Today.
Oh, yes, much better. The only thing wrong with them is that the paper itself is going to pieces. Now, I gave them, for example, the Chicago paper in which when the Hindenburg caught fire and went down at Lakehurst, New Jersey in
1937.
The Chicago paper had a full, from 135mm Kodachrome, did a full outside wrap around color reproduction, and then they had about half a dozen small ones in the center spread. Well, that's historically an important thing because that was the first use of Kodachrome film in newspaper reproduction, color reproduction. Then the Milwaukee Journal was one of the most important newspapers to pioneer in the color field. And I've given Bob quite a lot of Milwaukee Journals about that. And the Miami Herald, those are the two important pioneers in color reproduction from modern color films. And I'll slowly get them out and send them over. It so happened that the graphic arts research group in Kodak came to my division, so we had people who were well up in the project. Well, I think I've probably bragged enough.
Yeah, can we take you out to lunch?
I appreciate it, Andy, but Larry Wells and Marge just drove in.
That's right.
And I really think I ought to go back and see them.
You better.
Yeah.
I have to take them at lunch myself.
Well, right, thank you very much. But some other time, I'll get back. I've been in England until October 4th.
Well, thank you very much.
Right.
An interview with Ansel Adams on our Brett Weston project. Adams. This is the background interview with Ansel.